I'm Stephanie Wilson, and you're listening to Freedom Over Fascism.
But we make the road by walking, right? Like we're talking about basically the fundamental core of everything that your podcast and your listeners, you know, want. And it is on us, right? We live in an information environment where we are inundated with misinformation and disinformation. And we kind of have to like speak up and say no, and we have to become part of our media landscape.
Hi, folks. Welcome back. This week, I talked to Brian Hansberry, the co-founder of the Media and Democracy Project, about the failure of the corporate media and what we can do to influence the way they're covering politics and this moment in our history. He says, we make the road by walking it, which is itself a call to action. We can't wait for a billionaire to buy pro-democracy media outlets, although we need to encourage it. Or for people like Tara McGowan, who has done a tremendous service by founding the openly pro-democracy Courier Newsroom. We need to be walking that road and talking to anyone we pass along the way about the true stakes of this election. And what MAGA is doing now in MAGA-captured states, they'll do nationally if Trump wins. This year, we've talked a lot about journalism and the need to understand the stakes of this election from multiple points of view. As I record this on Monday, April 8th, I've read two really important articles that I want to share here. The first is Judd Legum, who writes and edits the Substack Popular Information. And he is a master of investigative reporting, which, as you'll hear from Brian, is on the decline. Judd's column talks about how Ted Cruz is violating campaign finance law, in addition to being a corrupt and sleazy guy, by taking revenue from his iHeartRadio podcast, which has been syndicated and plays on thousands of radio stations across the country, and earns hundreds of thousands of dollars in ad revenue. And he's taken that revenue and funneled it to his super PAC. Why is that important? Because he spouts disinformation regularly to an enormous number of people. And I'm going to quote here from Judd's column. iHeart spends millions of dollars lobbying Congress each year. Many of the issues targeted by iHeart fall under the purview of the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee, where Cruz is the ranking member. In 2023, Cruz sponsored legislation prohibiting automakers from removing AM radios from some cars. iHeart owns more than 250 AM stations. I really recommend reading this article and then going and donating to Colin Allred and telling your friends, especially in Texas, about this. Also this morning, Rick Wilson published some of Trump's social media posts, which threaten the lives of the judges in his trials in the style of a mob hit, and amounts to, will someone rid me of this turbulent priest? Or, it would be a shame if something were to happen. His real words were, until someone steps in, which seems pretty clear to me. Once again, our main power here is to tell people we know in real life to be the messengers that the political media refuses to be, and let people know what will happen to them if MAGA is elected. Those of you in MAGA capture states already know because you're living it. So we've got to prevent the same at the national level. In this conversation with Brian Hansberry, we hear about what the Media and Democracy Project is doing and what you can do to help with it. And in brighter news, this podcast just signed up our first founding member. Thank you, Susan DeVoe of Indiana. If you would like to help keep us going, you can become a paid subscriber at the Substack, which you can find at freedomoverfascism.substack.com. And believe me, I know it's hard to subscribe to all the outlets you want to support because it's expensive. Still, I'll ask. Now, here's my conversation with Brian Hansberry. Brian Hansberry, welcome to Freedom Over Fascism.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. As we are moving closer and closer to the 2024 presidential election, in which the stakes are nothing less than continued democracy or dictatorship. The legacy media is failing to cover politics responsibly, as part, as an institution in democratic systems. Recently, NBC hired and then fired Ronna McDaniel, who is someone who helped Trump and his allies conspire to stop the peaceful transfer of power. And it was only after their news personalities publicly denounced the move that NBC reversed its decision. I'd like to ask you, as co-founder of Media and Democracy Project, what you think the state of the legacy media, corporate media, is right now in terms of how it's covering democracy? And what's your take on the idea that politics is information warfare?
Yeah, well, thank you. There's a lot for me to tackle there. You know, this Ronna McDaniel thing that happened at NBC is just indicative of everything that we've been talking about and everything that caused us to come together as regular citizens and start this group. And, you know, you said sort of like what's happening right now with our media and its failure of democracy. And, you know, it's been happening for a long time. It just with this Ronna McDaniel situation, you know, in January of 2021, right, January 29th, 2021, The Washington Post published an article titled RNC Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel is trying to hold together a party that Donald Trump might want to tear up, right? This is like a puff piece written right after January 6th about someone who was already publicly known to have been participating in the big lie, right? So we have this big reaction. You know, Chuck Todd now is on air with Kristen Welker on NBC's Meet the Press, and he's saying, you know, our bosses owe you an apology, right? Chuck Todd, when he was the host of Meet the Press, was bringing insurrectionists, you know, fomenters of the coup attempt, big liars, he was bringing them onto his show back then in 2021, also in the month of January, right? And thanking them for their time at the end, right? In 2021, in December, he was criticized for bringing people like Roger Marshall, a senator who had participated in the big lie. He brought him on his show, and he was attacked for that. And here's a quote from him. He said, "Now it depends. There are some elected officials who aren't even worthy of letting them explain the position that they have." Okay. But you've got a guy like Roger Marshall, who's a medical doctor who has credibility trying to fight the vaccine mandate, okay, trying to extend the pandemic. And I always say here, whether you like it or not, it's the voters who make these folks credible because they put them in office. So Chuck Todd, seemingly right now in, you know, March, April of 2024, has very different beliefs about what being a responsible journalist who is, you know, beholden to truth and facts and reality and who is against lies and misinformation and disinformation. He's had a huge turnaround. And this goes all the way back to, remember, Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post in 2016 wrote a piece called "Calm Down, We'll Be Fine No Matter Who Wins." In 2018, she wrote a piece called "Calm Down, Roe v. Wade Isn't Going Anywhere." So this speaks largely to the problem we have with a commercialized corporate system of informing the public. There are incentives in these corporate offices that become systemized. We live in a system of information, right? And when we understand that it's a profit-motivated system for informing the public, we can then start to think about, well, how do we detach ourselves from that? And how do we push for things like more robust public media so that we can ultimately solve these issues? Because when it comes down to it, everything about our politics, our decisions at the ballot box, and how our society, you know, functions, and whether we're happier or more successful, and there are fewer children suffering from poverty. All of that stuff comes down to media concerns and the effects of media on how we think and how we apply that to our political decisions.
That's absolutely true. And you recounted a couple of times when Chuck Todd had a different opinion, but all along, this whole reliance on horse race or sports scores polling, and both sides are the same, has been really detrimental. Stephanie Shriok, former president of Emily's List, wants donors to think about buying media stations, which I think it is amazing to think about. And I just talked to Tara McGowan, the founder and publisher of Courier Newsroom, which is local media in 10 battleground states. So there are a few small pro-democracy media companies, but they're all a little bit niche. How do you think we should approach how to get people to understand what the stakes really are?
Yeah, you know, it's all of your listeners paying attention to what we're doing. It's all of your listeners starting to realize and fundamentally understand that importance of media to democracy, right? Like, you know, this podcast is called Freedom Over Fascism, right? And local journalism is at the core of democracy, you know, journalism in general, but local journalism especially. Where there's robust local journalism, more people vote, more people run for office. There's less government waste and corruption because someone, you know, is looking. So the first step is for just Americans to become aware of these issues, right? Like people may hear like, oh, journalism is dying, you know. They may see a stat, if we're lucky on our end, because we want people to know these things, but they may see a stat like half of all journalism jobs have disappeared since 2005. But do they know what that really means for them, right? Like there's a study that shows that every dollar that is spent on investigative journalism saves taxpayers money, right? Because with people watching what's going on at City Hall and at the state capitol, there's less opportunity for, you know, politicians to act in a corrupt manner. So how do we go about this is we start to understand as citizens that it's hugely our responsibility, right? We need to be out there demanding media that acts in the public interest. And we need to be supporting the institutions and journalism outlets that are pro-democracy, right? So we have these, you know, nonprofit journalism outlets like, you know, ProPublica is a great example. And, mm-hmm. you know, we wouldn't know so much about this Supreme Court corruption if it wasn't for these major stories from ProPublica. Our corporate media, you know, our $7 billion New York Times is not, with such a robust, you know, amount of money behind them, is not doing nearly enough of that investigative reporting because they are a for-profit company that is trying to appeal to as many people as possible and, you know, carry the interests of a corporate mindset, right? So like, for instance, just one more stat here, you know, when the striking auto workers won, you know, major concessions a couple years ago, the story about that was 39th on online Washington Post, right? So it's about like understanding fundamentally that we need to support local journalism, that we need to support the nonprofits that are doing like really great work. And then beyond that, the major vision is for us all to get behind, you know, legislation and push for legislation and push our politicians to back policy that supports journalism and especially local journalism. And just we have on our website, mediaanddemocracyproject.org, we've put together a directory of local journalism that is a 50 statewide and our territories list. It's a searchable directory so that you can sort of start that process of detaching yourself from the commercial media and, you know, for lack of better options, like robust, you know, public media options that we all want, you can start that process of detaching and supporting local journalism.
I think that sounds really great. But right now, for me, I don't watch any digital news except on clips.
Sure.
You know, 2-minute clips on Twitter. But I get a lot of information from independent journalists who publish on Substack.
Right.
Judd Legum, Aaron Rupar. I mean, there's the list is long. I'm sure our listeners feel this, and I feel it from the other side too, is if you pay for every single one of those newsletters that you find valuable, that's extraordinarily expensive.
Absolutely.
So finding a way where, you know, I tell our listeners, you know, that we,
are the most important piece of this that we need to be telling everyone we know about what the stakes of the election are, you know, why it's important to vote, what Trump would do if he takes office, and how that would matter at the state and local level as well. But right now, you know, it seems like it's so distributed that it's really hard to find high quality information and be able to afford it.
Absolutely. You know, the Washington Post has their tagline, democracy dies in darkness, but we like to say democracy dies behind a paywall. And, you know, it's true. And I really appreciate you saying, like, Brian, that sounds all well and good, you know, but like, we have to deal with the reality that we have right now. But we make the road by walking, right? Like, we're talking about basically the fundamental core of everything that your podcast and your listeners, you know, want. And it is on us, right? We live in an information environment where we are inundated with misinformation and disinformation. And we kind of have to like speak up and say no. And we have to become part of our media landscape. We have to write letters to the editor. We have to make choices as consumers that are hard, like you're saying. Like, we're all working hard. We might not have the funds to get this information. So there are things that we can support. And again, there's no quick fix, just like there's no quick fix for the democracy and fascism problems that we face, right?
Right.
We have to grind it out. And the more people who get on board, the better. Like in Washington, D.C. right now, there's a program that basically is like news coupons, right? It's a program that is similar to, and maybe has this group involved, Democracy Policy Network, with something called local news dollars. And there's this pilot program where they're giving citizens money for them to spend on news outlets, right? And
wow.
If you are a member of an organization and you want to, you know, reach out to Democracy Policy Network, or if you want to find out more, you can research what's going on in DC. You can find the people who put that together, and you can get that maybe something that's, you know, on the ballot or before City Hall in your location, right? It's about these, you know, grassroots from the ground up efforts.
And we talk a lot about that here, that almost to a person, when I ask people who are involved in politics and policy at the national level, when I ask, what can our activist listeners do? The answer is anything locally. Whatever
Absolutely.
You can do in your own backyard is the most important thing you can do. And so I'm really taking this to heart, but I also know that, you know, our audience in particular is activists and candidates and some donors. And I think there's also, you know, a paradigm that we haven't really explored deeply yet, which is philanthropy funding. And Tara and I talked about it this week, and she basically said, you know, if you're going to exist as a news, pro-democracy news organization, whether it's, you know, a podcast like this or a huge endeavor like Courier, it's, you have to do all the things. You have to, you know, get money from philanthropers. You have to, philanthropists. You have to get sponsorships from people that, from groups that are pro-democracy. You need to also have a subscription basis that is part of it, but not all of it, so that people can get the information if they can't afford the subscription. So what are your thoughts on how, as a system, we move this forward?
Sure. So I think you're talking about, you know, politics and political activism on the center and the left. And you're right that there is a gross disparity. We're a nonpartisan pro-democracy organization, but the reality that cannot be ignored is that there is a well-established, deeply funded, extreme right media infrastructure in our country that not only pollutes the information systems for people who lean right, But then that also like bleeds into and pollutes our entire national discourse, right? CRT, DEI, trans rights, all of these things are things that we would not be talking about if it wasn't for people like Christopher Rufo at the Manhattan Institute, like, you know, ginning up these controversies, right? And, you know, everything that exists outside of that extreme right, anti-democracy system deserves, you know, funding and deserves a sort of equal amount of push behind it, because we deserve as citizens a wide range of opinion and diversity of information. And we do not get that. And so when we go back to talking about ownership, like you were just talking about, it's absolutely essential that we have more diverse media ownership. We need to break up and prevent the media monopolies that we have. And, you know, there's a lot of history there for why that's the case, right? There's the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which, you know, just rolled back a lot of protections about media consolidation. And it's only gotten worse from there at every sort of critical decision point. And so I'm not going to advocate for one political persuasion or the other, but the reality is that donors on the left do not believe that information and media investment is sort of important to their cause. And that's a pretty bizarre take when you look out your door at what's going on in America and the influence that people who largely traffic in disinformation are able to have on our politics and our political outcomes. So you're absolutely right. It comes down to ownership. It comes down to investment, funder and philanthropic investment. I mean, ProPublica, it has, you know, philanthropic investment like at its core and is why it was able to get off the ground and be as important to our democracy and our understanding of, you know, corruption at the very top of our government. So you're right. How do we do that? We do things like we talk about this on this podcast, and we get people to understand that, you know, no matter what their political priority, no matter what you care about, climate change, you know, bodily autonomy, no matter what it is, gun reform, your effort will not be nearly as successful if you don't do something about the information that everyone absorbs and takes in this country.
Right. So yeah, as much as we talk about it, each issue, and we get our messaging to be, you know, well thought through and well researched, if people aren't hearing it, it's by definition not effective. But I think that we underestimate the effect of kind of the information surround that's sort of in the ether, right? So you can be, you know, very few people are like you and me who really source our information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of people out there watching even MSNBC, which you would think would be different, is not, aside from a few hosts. But
sure.
And even if you knock on all the doors in America, they're still going to go home and be watching Fox or CNN or something in which democracy is not the highest priority.
Where absolutely.
This false idea of neutrality is driving coverage.
Right.
And neutrality has never been a part of, aside from in the last 50 years, this idea that media can be neutral. It's not part of the history of journalism, you know?
No.
And newspapers had points of view.
Absolutely.
And they still do, only they're trying not to tell you what it is.
Yeah. I mean, America is an amazing place in terms of, you know, the freedom to be able to say whatever you want, right? But, and we do have that robust history. I mean, you know, the founders believed that, you know, people should have access to as much information as possible. And, you know, basically until like the 1940s in our country, you know, newspapers, and they all had an ideological bent, but hopefully the best ones were still trafficking in truth as pinned down by facts and reality, right? there's this incredible stat that at some point in the 1800s, like 90% of the weight of all mail was, you know, pamphlets and newspapers. The extensive road system that existed in the 1800s was the result of the founders prioritizing the spread of information and building roads so that, you know, postal roads, right? And so this idea of neutrality is something that came to fore in, you know, the 1940s with the professionalism of journalism in response to complaints by reformers of, you know, an excess of commercialism and press excesses in general. And so they said, okay, well, listen, you know, we're being brought before Congress here. We're going to like codify some professional norms. And, you know, they created this myth, this mystique of like professional journalism, which is, you know, we are objective. Mm-hmm. But objectivity in and of itself is a myth. And it was back then and it is now. You can pretend to be as objective as you want as a journalist. And you can also, like, you know, work hard to try to achieve objectivity in terms of, you know, sourcing the opinions of a diverse group of people. But every single thing that goes into the production of your MSNBC show, your CNN show, your newspaper article is a choice. The choice of what to cover, the mm-hmm. choice of how to frame it, the choice of whether you're going to put it on the front page of your website, the front page of your print paper, or, you know, page A17, right? So objectivity, when we start to like look closely at it, really becomes this false notion. And we exist in this commercial system that has a profit incentive to appeal to as many people as possible and to get access to politicians for scoops. There's this, you know, mainstream journalism belief of neutrality that truth lies directly in the middle between two sides. And that's absurd, right? And so what we really need is journalism that has a public interest at heart, journalism that, you know, talks about solutions to problems, explores all aspects of them, relies on experts and less on politicians. And you know, that's what we need to fight for.
As you started our conversation talking about investigative journalism, and we have much less of that now than we have ever had, or maybe it exists, but in tiny corners. And it seems that what the big players in news are doing more than investigating facts is surrounding themselves with people of different opinions whose analysis substitutes for facts. And that opens us up to all sorts of mis and disinformation, because whatever they say is taken as truth, whether it's got any basis in truth or fact whatsoever. And that has its roots in, you know, what kind of access, if they employ Ronna McDaniel, what kind of access do they get to people in Trump's orbit, or even, you know, on the other side too, what kind of access are they going to get and what kind of opinions are they going to get? And it seems that the harder work of investigative journalism, the Woodward and Bernsteins, those deep, deep investigations that have really opened up issues that people didn't know about, are whether it's this corporate motive or whether they think it's more, well, if they think it's more interesting, it's the same thing, right? What gets engagement? What gets clicks? And I'm interested in hearing what you think about this dynamic.
Yeah. You know, something that's been revealed sort of by this Ronna McDaniel thing is that, you know, producers, first of all, I just want to say that cable news is poison in terms of an information diet. All apologies to the MSNBC viewers out there, you know, and the CNN viewers and, you know, even the Fox viewers, right? Cable news is going to be the least informative, because to keep you watching through that commercial break, they do need to push opinion and drama and sensationalism on you, And, you know, you may believe that, you know, the pundit that you like is really doing a great job of bringing on knowledgeable guests, you know, lawyers and experts, you know, to talk about things going on with Trump and things like that. But what aren't they covering? How little time are they spending on foreign affairs? How little time are they spending? I mean, if you want to like really like cut through the BS, right? Think about, you know, the majority of us are workers. How often are like workers' rights, unions, like organizing? How often is that covered as it's delivered to all of us, the people who are workers who would really benefit from, you know, hearing about unionization efforts and those kinds of things, right? Think for 1 or 2 seconds about how much you're hearing just about the sensationalism of Trump versus everything else that's getting pushed to the side by that, you know, hour after hour, every single night on these cable news programs. But what we learned about the Ronna McDaniel thing or through that thing is that, you know, investigative journalism and sending people out, like when it comes to TV, sending people out, you know, to interview people, to talk to experts, to gather, you know, like deeply sourced information that would help us all make decisions at the ballot box, that costs money. And when you're trying to enhance your money, you're just going to hire like 3 people who, you know, you can count on. They're not going to get you in trouble by saying, you know, unpredictable things. They're not going to cause a controversy, right? You're going to be able to deliver to people a successful product that keeps them engaged and makes the advertisers who you deal with happy, right? So,
right.
You know, investigative journalism is expensive, and that's why we get so much less of it in the corporate, world of media at this point. And why, when someone is actually sent out, right, it's to cover something sensational. The New York Times goes to thousands of diners over the last 8 years all across rural America to interview Trump supporters because that's appeals to both the Trump supporters who might be watching and it appeals to the people of every other persuasion who can't believe what they're seeing and hearing, right? When CNN sends somebody out, they send them to the border or they send that Donnie guy to like go ask Trump supporters something, right? Like, right. Are we getting informed? Are we learning about so many other aspects of our society and hearing the diverse range of opinions? No. So you're spot on. Investigative journalism is expensive. And so we get much, much less of it in a corporate commercialized system for informing us.
So back to what we as activists and listeners and donors and thinkers can be doing right now.
Yeah. Well, so I've often when I appear places, I'm really remiss because I forget to talk about what we're doing.
Yes. Talk about what you're doing.
Sure. So especially with this Ronna McDaniel thing, which I do think a couple of weeks from now is still going to be something that resonates and is being talked about because it's really exposed this thing that we're talking about in general, this commercial system. But so what we've done is in 2022, we put together a list of pro-democracy election coverage guidelines, right? Like ahead of the midterms. We've revisited them for 2024 and we have an open letter that we're asking folks to sign onto. And basically, our guidelines break down into 3 sections. It is cover elections like they matter more than sports. I mean, really, when it comes down to it, like treat the public with respect, like cover substantive issues, not like Steve Kornacki standing shouting at you like he's like, you know, breaking down a football play and you're not getting any information about issues that matter to you when you go to the ballot box, right?
And might I add that there are people putting thumbs on the scale of what he's talking about by flooding the zone with bad polling. So you've all heard me say this, and I'm still going to say it. The horse race polls are bullshit and stop paying attention. Okay. That was my PSA.
No, absolutely. We literally were trying to reach everyone where they are. So when you say like horse race, that's why we changed it to sports scores, right? Because like horse race, maybe some people aren't familiar with that term, right? But like, and horse racing, you know, used to be much more popular, right? But
that's true.
But so another one of our guidelines is, you know, stop making predictions and pushing polls at the expense of issues coverage, right? And, you know, another of the top headlines is make threats to democracy clear, right? Mm-hmm. Abandon that false equivalence that we see all the time between traditional and fascistic candidates, and protect Americans from disinformation, right? Inoculate Americans against what we can expect to be a repeat of the big lie strategy if Trump loses, right? Like, there just are going to be more and more lies. And when, you know, when you do something like in 2021, September 2021, the New York Times, Reed Epstein, wrote an article with the headline, "When will Trump answer the big 2024 question?" Right? I mean, what are we doing? What are we even doing? Things have become so ridiculous and so normalized by our mainstream media that, you know, we don't realize often that this gentleman facilitated a coup. He called politicians in Georgia and demanded that they find exactly the number of votes for him to win. He and Ronna McDaniel called Michigan and said, "We'll get you lawyers, you know, undermine democracy so that we can cheat and we'll get you lawyers," right? Mm-hmm. So our guidelines are a plea to people like Cesar Conde. We're going to send this open letter to the executives and publishers of our major news institutions, and we are going to ask them to treat us better, to uplift democracy, right? To defend democracy in the face of these deep threats. And, you know, they're under threat too, right? Donald Trump has said that he wants journalists to be put in jail until they give up their sources once they realize that they have like a prison girlfriend. Like, forget how offensive that is. I mean, it's dangerous and scary. And so we need people to sign on to our letter. You can go to our website, mediaanddemocracyproject.org. Under our work, we have 2024 election coverage. And you click on that, you sign the open letter, and then we are going to send that to these executives who have clearly shown that they put profit and access above democracy and a responsibility to informing us. Like, informing us is such a secondary consideration in our corporate commercialized system for informing the public. And we need to tell them that we actually want to be informed.
So I'm going to ask you the hard and maybe obnoxious question, but
great.
What do you think is actually going to be achieved with an open letter like this?
Sure. I'll be real with you because, you know, you framed it for me that it would be difficult. So, so do we expect that Cesar Conde and the Budoff Brown lady and Rashida Jones, you know, do we expect that they will suddenly have this, you know, the revelations that have come out about the Ronna McDaniel thing are that they, after the fact, and while people were complaining and their own, you know, stars were saying on air, like, this is wrong, that they really didn't get it. You know, Cesar Conde's apology is totally inadequate and doesn't speak at all to what the issue and the complaints were, that you're hiring someone who, you know, participated in a coup. And so what the point of it really is getting all of us active and giving all of us a guide by which we can look at the coverage that we're getting and understand how fundamentally inadequate it is. And so it's also becomes then a rubric by which you, listening to this right now, can reach out to these institutions and send them a letter to the editor, give them a comment. You know, the New York Times got rid of their public editor in 2017, and they said, Dean Baquet was like, you know, we don't need a public editor anymore because, you know, our listeners and readers on social media are the best watchdog that there possibly could be. Well, they just ignore everybody, right? So we have to raise a ruckus and be unable to be ignored. And that includes taking our dollars away. And that includes demanding better. And so we've done rubrics before. We have a climate change rubric and an abortion coverage rubric by which people can see, like, if you don't see coverage that talks about this, write a letter to the editor and here's some points you can make. Well, this effort, and we've gotten sign-on, by the way, you know, it's about popularizing these types of demands that people can make, right? We have availability bias in our brains and in our society. We don't know what's possible because we aren't given what's possible, right? So we need to work hard and come together to make things possible, to make a better information system real. And so what we are achieving with this effort and with this sign-on letter that has been signed by Ruth Van Giot, that's been signed by Victor Picard, who's like my hero in this niche world of media scholarship, been signed by Jen Senko, who made this amazing documentary, The Brainwashing of My Dad. And we're hoping to get a lot of other great people to sign on, including all of you listening. You know, we need to start building these groundswells, right? Like on the far right, there's major funding that, you know, for instance, Moms for Liberty, right? Moms for Liberty within a year had over 200 chapters. Well, anyone who's involved in grassroots organizing knows that that's impossible without billionaires giving you that money to make that happen, right? And paying people to like create all of that. Well, we don't have that. There's no such thing. You know, George Soros is a total projection. You know, like that doesn't exist for the majority of grassroots organizations. And so what we need to do is we just need to come together as citizens and realize that we have power. You know, it wasn't just the people at MSNBC and NBC who were the stars who complained. It was regular Americans who said, look, this is way too beyond the pale. So we need to come together, and that's what these guidelines are all about. It's about giving people something that they can reference when they then become a part of their media landscape and become a part of the conversation and demand better from executives who have risen to where they are because, you know, they don't get it. They're not interested in informing us.
Hey, your TED Talk. I give little PSAs and TED Talks all the time. So you hear it, listeners, that's your call to action. And mine too. I mean, I don't think we should fool ourselves that it was just that Rachel Maddow had a 30-minute segment about it, but it's Rachel Maddow, people who tune in and support it because of Rachel Maddow, that it's the dollars that are driving this just as much as anything else.
It is. I want to say one more kind of inspiring thing, what I hope to be inspiring. Because you know, we are just a little grassroots organization. We don't, you know, we are a 501c4, but all of that money goes basically to fund what I'm about to talk about. Any money that we do get, you know, we are real David and Goliath right now in another effort of ours, which is we have a petition to deny a broadcast license before the FCC. And what we are doing is, and this is another thing that you can sign on to, another letter. This letter goes to people working at the FCC. We filed this petition last August based on rules that the FCC has had for a long time on character and non-broadcast misconduct. And so what we're doing is we're asking the FCC to open a hearing into the broadcast license for Fox 29 in Philadelphia. And what we're saying is that, you know, the revelations in the Dominion lawsuit against Fox and the Murdochs revealed that at the highest levels of Fox, including the owners, Rupert and Lachlan Murdoch, at the highest levels, they were aware of these lies and they allowed these lies to be told, and there was news distortion on their cable network. So that the FCC cannot regulate cable, but that constitutes non-broadcast misconduct, right? And the FCC has rules that say, if you are of a low enough character that you cannot be trusted with this public institution, this right to broadcast over the public airwaves, you can have your broadcast license revoked. And we think it's abundantly clear that the Murdochs are not fit to broadcast over our public airwaves to the American people. So that's another thing you can do. And that's kind of what I'm talking about. It's like these guidelines, sure, it's an open letter. It's going to these executives, you know, but then there's another effort that we have that actually has some legs and actually could, you know, have a major impact on what is so important, what you touched on earlier, which is ownership, right? There is a responsibility if you own a major media organization to the public to provide factual information and not to distort the news. So it's all of these things collectively. And, you know, if one effort seems like, you know, I don't know, is that going to have as big of an impact? Well, that one effort could become something much bigger, you know, at any time. We don't know. We have to make the road by walking.
Thank you so much, Brian, for coming and talking to us. We have to make the road by walking is going to go up on my list of sayings along with hope is an action.
It is not my own. It is, I got it from a guy, Miles Horton, who it was an activist and organizer, I think like in the 30s, like in Appalachia. And he has an amazing book that is a conversation with him with Pablo Freire, who wrote The Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And, you know, these two people are talking back and forth about, you know, how they made things happen. And that's always stuck with me. Yeah. I mean, nothing happens unless you make it happen. You don't move forward unless you move forward. Sorry, I cut you off.
No, you cut me off with something really interesting. So I just want to thank you for coming on, and we would love to have you again. And I'm glad that you were able to talk to us about some of the behind the scenes, what's going on with our media. It's one of the pillars of what I talk about here, because we have to know how to say things, but also how to have them heard. And so it's really important. And I invite you to come on back.
Okay.
Let us know how things are going.
Literally anytime. The more that any of us can speak about this issue, which again, really touches every issue, right? And impacts the success of everything that you want to see improved about our country and our pursuit of happiness. Like, I can't wait for the next time to come back on.
Thank you for listening to Freedom Over Fascism. And thank you to our editor, Benji Wilson. Please join our Patreon at patreon.com/freedomoverfascism. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. And please drop us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. We thank you for choosing freedom over fascism.